Broadcasting live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's time for Point Taken. Here are your hosts, Steve Scafidi and Kristen Bride.
And good morning, everybody. Welcome to the Tuesday show. Kristen is off for the next week. I'll be filling in. Well, I'm usually here anyway. We have a special guest in the news, as they say, Maulkin County Executive David Crowley. Always great to see you.
Always a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So your big news was?
My big news is that I am entering the governor's race to run to be the next governor of the state of Wisconsin.
All right, so you always got to ask the why question. Why you, why now?
A great question. I mean, one, you know, I spent 7 years in the state capitol, so I know exactly how Madison works, and I've been able to get a lot done with our legislature. And for the past 5 years, I have been leading the largest and most populated county in the state of Wisconsin. I represent close to 1 million people. I also manage one of the largest budgets. And the issues that we have been able to tackle have been things that matter to Wisconsin families. Things like public safety, public health, fiscal recovery. We've invested in small businesses. We've created more affordable and attainable housing. We've made government more accessible, and we've cut taxes. And so I know that I'm the only candidate in this race who not only has legislative experience, but also experience running a government.
Now, you know what the critics say. Milwaukee County can't get their act together. We got crime, you know, blah, blah, blah. It's on the text line every day. I read it. I read all those texts. What's your response to that, as leading the biggest county in the state?
Well, every community, large community across the entire country, has its share of challenges. But I want to be very clear. I'm not a city mayor. I represent Milwaukee County, which is 19 different municipalities, cities and villages of all different sizes. And you know what? I haven't pulled and done things for Milwaukee County. We figured out how to deliver for residents across the entire state. I led a coalition to bring back more money to communities of all sizes in Wisconsin, back from Madison, so folks can invest in things like public safety, invest in fixing the damn roads, and invest in things that makes the quality of life for their residents that much better.
I think people forget that. It's the Oak Creek, it's the Franklin, it's the West Dallas, West Milwaukee, all of those, you know, the ring suburbs. That's part of your leadership.
That is a part of my leadership. So it's not just the city. I represent a plethora of people. Again, it's almost 1 million people in the county.
So if somebody asked you, and they probably will on the road today, you're going to be all over the place as part of your announcement. What are you most proud of the work that you have done in Milwaukee County? Just one or two things you think are really good examples of your leadership.
Well, one, I would say, you know, Act 12, being able to, you know, not only benefit Milwaukee County, but all communities across this state. Act 12 was extremely huge, being able to provide not only the services and programs that people rely on, but it helped with the $3.2 billion pension reform. We helped to cut taxes, the largest property tax cut in our county's history. And so that really helped us moving forward, but it didn't solve all of our problems. And I know that with the work that we have been able to do, the investments we've been able to make, we can scale that up for every community across this state.
As the chief executive of Milwaukee County, how are you prepared to go around the state? Will you go around the state talking to voters?
I absolutely will be going around the state. You know, folks want a governor who not only listens, but understands the issues on the ground. And it's important that those who are directly impacted can lend their voices to the solutions. And so I plan on going all across this state, listening to as many people as possible, because I do know that the biggest thing that folks are worried about is how are they going to be able to afford the things that they need moving forward, being able to afford their rent or mortgage, being able to put food on the table, being able to afford health care. Those aren't Democratic or Republican issues. Those aren't just Milwaukee issues. Those are issues that Wisconsin voters care about.
Let's take it beyond Milwaukee County. Mm-hmm. If you're running for governor, it's the whole state. It's all 72 counties. You said issues. What do you think is on the minds? And you haven't gone out to all 72 counties yet, I'm guessing. What do you think is on the minds of those citizens of this state?
Well, right now, what's on the minds of citizens across this state is how are we going to lessen the affordability crisis on families, right? And people are getting less even if they're making more money. And we need to figure out how do we bring them some level of relief. And I know what it's like to struggle. You know, I, growing up, was evicted 3 times before I graduated high school. I know what it's like not to know how your bills are going to get paid or how you're going to put food on the table. And while I recognize that there's only so much that we can do with a lot of the economic chaos that we're seeing in our state and across our country, that doesn't mean that we can't put up a plan and we can't work hard to provide that relief. And so we're going to talk about the issues of affordability, but we also need to talk about the need for more good paying, family sustaining jobs, the need to fully fund our public schools, as well as having access to affordable health care.
I got a specific question about the federal government and how it plays into Milwaukee County, and that's related to FEMA and mm-hmm. disaster we recently had. But on that sort of that concept, you have made a case, and I've talked to other Republican leaders who say you are very good at this, at working across the aisle. Mm-hmm. But when you're governor of the state of Wisconsin, you have to work with the president of the United States. How do you sort out that relationship? Because the president of the United States, current president, Donald J. Trump, has not been real friendly to Democratic governors, and probably not to the degree that those of us here, and that's the FEMA part of this, would like to see.
You know, what folks, you know, here in the state of Wisconsin understands, if you're workers, that you know, you don't have to like your worker in order to get things done. You don't have to like your colleague or your coworker to get things done. And I've been a county executive under the first Trump administration, now his second administration, as well as Biden's administration. And we've been able to deliver for the people of Milwaukee County with a Republican-controlled legislature. So no matter what, you know, I am willing to work with whoever I need to bring resources that's going to move our state forward.
If the president's, if you were lucky enough to be the nominee and then governor of the state of Wisconsin, mm-hmm. would you meet with the president when he came into Wisconsin?
I would always meet with the president. I respect the position, and I think it's important to respect the position. But we don't have to compromise on our values to get things done. And I'm always willing to pull up a seat at the table to work on behalf of the people I represent.
Milwaukee County Executive David Crowley joining us now, a Democratic nominee for the nomination for governor of the state of Wisconsin. From the text line, budget surplus is something that comes up a lot on our conversations on this program and on our station. How would you sort that out? What would you do with that budget surplus that's, I think, $4 billion or something like that?
Well, one, I think it's important to talk to the voters, right? People are having their own issues. Every community isn't the same. So we can't have a cookie-cutter approach to solving the issues across this state. And so what I would do looking at this surplus is look at, okay, how can we bring more affordable housing units online and attainable, right? We have to tackle the housing situation from both sides. And when I say affordability, those are for individuals who can't necessarily afford the rent. But there are people who make money at all income levels who can afford a home, yet there isn't a housing stock available for them. So how do we make sure that we're tackling the housing crisis? That helps with building up our property tax base. That helps with building up great neighborhoods. How do we invest in small businesses? Many of our entrepreneurs who are going to be hiring the individuals who work locally in our community, helping give a jolt to that local economy. But it's important that, again, we talk to our legislators, we talk to our community, and we come up with a vision that helps everybody, because we want to make sure that when the tide rises, all the boats rise.
Any specifics that you can highlight that's something that seems like a no-brainer? Healthcare, something like that.
You're hitting on a few of them. Childcare, healthcare, public schools. Like, how do we fully fund our public school systems, making sure that our children are not just ready for the employment opportunities that are here now, but how do we really set them up for what our economy looks like in the future? And it's hard for our young people, our kids, to even worry about their schooling when they don't know where they're going to lay their head down at night, when they don't know how they're going to eat that evening. And that's why housing has to be a part of this. But when we're talking about young families, right, you know, my youngest daughter is turning 6 later on this year. And so last year I was grateful when I had to stop paying for childcare and daycare, because it is expensive. And for many folks, not only is it expensive, they might not even have access to a childcare facility in general. So we need to figure out, how do we put our state in the best position to make sure that our families, working families, can get caught up and can feel like they can get a piece of that American dream again.
I know you got a busy schedule. Two quick ones. The Milwaukee County Act, or something you worked on that you're most proud of?
The Milwaukee County Act that I am most proud of. Oh, wow. I would say the Housing First work that we have done. You know, in the past 5 years, Milwaukee County, we've been recognized of having the lowest unsheltered homeless population per capita than any other community our size across the country. And the level of affordable housing and attainable housing that we have built, as well as how we've been tackling the opioid epidemic, will be some of my highlights.
And I can verify that, because I've talked to some people who have worked on that effort. If you pay attention to something, you can actually make progress, and that's something that Milwaukee County should be proud of.
Absolutely.
And this is sort of a fun one. What'd your wife say when you decided to make this decision?
My wife kind of gave me the side eye, right? Because,
I've experienced that as well.
She assumed that this would come up, but, you know, neither one of us thought it would be happening this quick. But I am glad and extremely happy that my better three quarters is with me 100%.
Yeah. Some say the smarter one.
She is the smarter one. I married up.
There you go. As did I. Waukee County Executive David Crowley, now a candidate for governor. As always, thanks for sharing your time.
Thank you for the moment.
All right, lots more to come. We got Mary Quinn, Jim Santel on all the legal aspects of all things this administration and beyond. That's coming up on Point Taken, 620 WTMJ. All right, thanks for tuning in on this Tuesday. Lots of moving pieces today. We jump right into our legal conversation. You know these two guests, contributors to the program, often throughout the tenure of this show and the one before it. Mary Quinn, retired Milwaukee County judge. Jim Santel, former U.S. attorney. First of all, welcome back to both of you. It's
been to be with you again, Steve.
Yeah, been too long. We all have busy lives and lots of stuff going on, but let's get to it. I'm going to have one of you frame what happened. It's one of these, what do they call it? Not the secret docket or what it was?
Emergency docket.
Emergency
shadow
docket,
right? Once again.
Yeah, it seems to be something, just my opinion as a layperson, that we're seeing more and more of.
Yes, there's a huge increase. The statistics are that there have been 20 of these, 20 applications, a great majority of them granted. When you go back to the Bush and the Obama years, there were something like 8 over the period of 16 years. We've had 40 in Trump's first term and about 20, more than 20 of them in this term.
So let's talk about the most recent one handed down yesterday. It's not a lot of information attached to it other than some brief comments. Lay it out for us.
So what you have underlying this is a district court judge. She's Central California, and her name is Judge Maim Frimpong, F-R-I-M-P-O-N-G. And a few weeks ago, she's got a hearing on the mechanisms by which law enforcement there in Los Angeles, domestic and military, can detain and arrest people. And Mary knows, she's taught about this. I like to think I've done the same thing. What the judge says is you can't arrest somebody based upon just race or ethnicity. Can't arrest them because they're speaking Spanish or with an accent of English. You can't do it because they're present at a certain location, because they've got a certain job, or they're performing a particular type of work. You can't do any of that. You got to have a reasonable suspicion is the standard that's been the case for tens of years, if not beyond that.
And let me just interrupt for 1 second. And reasonable suspicion, folks, and Steve, is based on objective criteria, like somebody's driving down the road with a broken taillight. Is that a basis, an objective basis for law enforcement to pull them over? Yes, it is. These criteria that Jim has just laid out are not objective, and that's a major sticking point that I think Jim can address in terms of what the issues that it can raise for people's individual rights.
And so what happens is, you've got it, Steve, just right, is that the Supreme Court, without any explanation, that's the problem once again. Basically, this is a 6-3 decision. We get something from Kavanaugh as well, which we can talk about, lifted that judge's order prohibiting government agents from making those indiscriminate immigration-related stops. And challengers, of course, are calling this blatant racial profiling. The Supreme Court is letting that happen as of this morning.
So for both of you, and we'll start with Mary, it seems outside of how we've looked at this issue forever, and now we're going to just say, well, they look guilty, I'm going to go chase them down.
Well, and that's a big problem. We have a bunch of constitutional rights, including a 14th Amendment, including a 4th Amendment that keeps us free from unreasonable searches and seizures.
Right.
That you have to have a basis for when you're being intrusive into someone's life. And this is the first time where there's a hint that you can use, law enforcement can use clearly non-objective criteria to do these short detentions is what they're calling. And the only difference that, you know, as I try to work through this in my own mind as a judge, is that you're talking about this isn't really a stop for criminal activity. It could end up being that, but it's really stops that law enforcement has the right to do to determine whether or not you are legally in this country.
Is there a different set of rules for that?
There has not been, because oftentimes they are, once they are found that they are not legally in this country or can't produce the documentation to show that they are, then, and a lot of citizens don't walk around with their license on them or whatever, and they could get swept up in this as well. And it seems that the court is at least initially saying, well, the ends justifies the means, because we're going to get some, because Los Angeles has a 20% population of of immigrants that are illegally here in this country. And if you're going to sweep up 1,000, and a lot of them might be citizens, but you're going to get some non-citizens in there, some illegals, that seems to be justified. And we've never operated under those rules, that we are here to protect the rights of even the minority, the least among us. And this is a big shift. Now, the only thing I can say is it's the court has not ruled on the merits of this. Let's be clear about that. And this is where Jim and I have a little bit of a difference of opinion.
So define that quickly for the audience, because we've got to get the break.
They've just stayed the lower court's order saying that you can't do this to law enforcement. They've stayed that, and so law enforcement can continue to operate by these rules. While the case actually plays out in the courts and has a full hearing and briefing and so forth, I'm hopeful that when this gets to the Ninth Circuit and then eventually to the Supreme Court, that there's going to be a different ruling altogether. But right now, they're allowed to continue with this. The court has not made a ruling on whether what they're doing is legal or not. They're saying that it can stay for right now. It can go on for right now until we have a full hearing on the merits of the case.
Jim, I'm going to ask you a question after the break, but we'll take the break quickly so we can get to the news on time. You're listening, of course, to Point Taken on 620 WTMJ. News coming up at the bottom with Greg Matzek and, of course, ABC. Jim Santel, Mary Klingbeil, our guests on this hour, remaining hour of the program. And then we got another hour after that with more guests. Busy show today. All right, James, I'll ask it this way. Has this court, it's a penchant for using these emergency docket cases and then sort of letting the administration do things that we probably didn't see coming. Are they essentially just giving him approval? And in the meantime, he wins and... Some people think we lose.
The emergency docket is there for a reason. We've got a true emergency. We talked during the break about, for example, death penalty cases. You're about to execute someone. You can't take that one back, right? You got to act quickly on it. I ask about all of these questions involving terminations of people, changing the rules by which law enforcement acts. What is the emergency that you need to intervene and change the law?
Is the administration gaming the system?
Yes. In a word.
Yeah.
They are involving themselves in matters that they don't have to. Nor are they required to. And it's the most intrusive, in the most intrusive ways. If you want to talk about activist judges, this is the height of activism, by sticking your nose into this before the merits are even heard by a lower court.
Retired Milwaukee County Judge Mary Klingbeil, former U.S. Attorney Jim Santel. Lots more to get to. We'll continue the conversation. If you have a thought, 855-616-1620, Siding Limited, WTMJ Talk and Text Line. I already got some questions on the text line for our two guests. Lots more coming up, including the 10 o'clock hour conversation about MPS and education in general with my friend Collison Morgan. That's coming up a little bit later in the program. Thanks for joining us on our Tuesday trip. A lot of guests on the program today on Point Taken. Kristen is off for the next week. We will miss her, but we're going to continue on as best we can. Our guests in studio today, we have a lot of guests on the program, so stay close to your radio or wherever you're consuming our content. Mary Klingbeil, retired Milwaukee County Judge. Jim Santel, mm-hmm. former U.S. attorney who I worked closely with many years ago now.
Many years ago.
Shocking right. How long ago that was, 2012, right. The shooting at the Sikh Temple. Nora O'Donnell did an interview with Justice Amy Coney Barrett. I was curious, Mary and Jim, I'll start with you, Mary, on your thoughts about that interview. What she said, because that was essentially my takeaway was the questioner, Nora, was asking, has this court become politicized? And she had an interesting response to that, that basically she says, no, we're not doing that.
Yeah, and I think this is sort of an advance of her book tour, you know, for a book she wrote called Listening to the Law. And she wrote it primarily to give pushback to the what she calls disconnect between what the public perceives of the court and what's really going on, you know, in the inner workings of the court. And so it's no shock that she, some of the revelations that she gave were pretty much to be expected, which is that no, we don't have preconceived notions of how to rule on a case. We follow the law. All nine justices of us do that. She spoke in sort of a unifying way so that, you know, there weren't any cracks in the armor. She also spoke about, and gave pushback to, we don't, have an agenda. And even on this issue of what we were just talking about before the break, which is the shadow document, the one point that she made that I disagree with, it's almost as if she feels like, in the way she articulated it to Nora O'Donnell in the interview, was we are required. When a case comes on the emergency docket, we're required to hear it. And I don't agree with her on that. I've looked at and researched whether or not there is a Supreme Court rule whether there is a constitutional right to this. There isn't. You have to first ask yourself as a justice or as a judge, is this in fact an emergency? What's the underlying issue? What's the harm? Hold the government or the party bringing the case to you on an emergency basis to their burden of proof. And it seems as if they have lowered the bar very low here, and she doesn't seem to think that. I think that was the most unsettling of her responses. On the other hand, she gave some pretty serious comments about her willingness to take to parse through decisions on the law and part with her conservative or her liberal colleagues when she thinks that they're getting the law wrong. And she has shown herself to do that in some of the oral arguments, particularly when she early on was sort of debating out loud orally Clarence Thomas, which gave some people some hope that she might be more moderate than we thought, and it gave the conservatives, the right-wing people, concerns that they didn't want her on the bench because they thought she would be lockstep with President Trump. The final thing she talked about, which is near and dear to most judges and justices across this country, is a call for reform on the Supreme Court, which is to have a ethics code in place. She didn't give any kind of timeline, but she was very much in favor of it, thinks that it will help the bench and restore credibility to the courts. I agree with her on that, and I think they ought to make that a priority in this coming year.
Jim.
And to Mary's good point, she specifically says in the books, as long as litigants continue filing emergency applications, the courts must continue deciding them, basically saying, hey, you come to us, we've got to decide these cases. And she also says this, committing the court's reasoning to print risks hardening what should be tentative into something more definite. That's fascinating. That's what judges do. That's what the Supreme Court should do. Tell us what the law is. And yes, indeed, you decide the case right in front of you. But that reluctance, therefore, to give reasons, which we're talking about in the emergency docket, hugely problematic.
Well, I would say this, though, about that. As a judge, she actually is right. That's what I was trying to talk about. They haven't decided the merits. And they don't want to, don't mistake what we're saying initially or tentatively as the permanent view of the court. Well, we want to be able to have basically restore the status quo until we have an opportunity to really flesh this issue out. That's not speaking out of mouth or out of turn. I think most judges, when they have these emergency requests for stays of an act, they look at it that way. Look, this is a temporary thing until we can get the real facts in front of us and make a thorough decision. So in that respect, she's right. But when they don't meet their threshold, and it really isn't an emergency.
That's
I agree with
point.
You, Jim.
Right.
The point is, you can say no. No is a complete sentence, and that court needs to learn that.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but on the question of presidential power, didn't they throw that one back too? But essentially gave Trump the power anyway, right?
We forget that the first five pages of that amazing decision, Trump versus the United States, July 1 of 2024, first five pages of that, you've got the Supreme Court Chief Justice saying you can't have a feeble presidency. You've got to be active. You've got to be nimble. You've got to be strong, muscular. Those pages give any president, including this one, the commission to do what Donald Trump is doing right now. That's the law of the land right now. People think it's all about the immunities. It is. But those first pages in which they adopt this view of the presidency, a supreme presidency, a full presidency, those are compelling words, and that's the law of the land.
He is Jim Santel, Judge Mary Kunmensch, retired now. After the break, got a lot of great questions. We'll throw some of them at the judges. A lot of them I would expect to have seen on the text line, including, is it time for the lifetime appointments deal for Supreme Court justices to be looked at or examined? And how likely is that to happen? We'll ask our guests that question after this on Point Taken on 620 WTMJ. Continuing our conversation with retired Milwaukee County Judge Mary Kunmensch and former U.S. Attorney Jim Santel. Lots of questions on the text line, 855-616-1620. Kristen is off this week and through next, she'll be back next Tuesday. Yours truly, Steve's committee host and Point Taken on my own, which I'm sure I can handle. For both of you, we'll start with you, Jim. Is it time for a sort of a term limit, Supreme Court, 10 to 12 years or one term, whatever that would be?
There's some interesting language in the Constitution that says that federal judges remain in positions during periods of good behavior with a U in there in behavior, which is interesting. And that has been interpreted to mean lifetime tenure. And so people say, well, you got to change the Constitution to get outside and do some lifetime or term limits. There is some interesting legislation pending in the House and the Senate, introduced by some credible senators, some credible members of the House of Representatives. It says this. We're not going to strip you of your position. We're simply going to say that after, say, 10, 12 years for incoming justices, you're going to go on senior status, kind of an emeritus status, and you'll stay there, and maybe you'll run the circuits and decide larger cases. But your seat effectively there will be vacated so that there will, in fact, be somebody new coming in. It's a fascinating concept that arguably doesn't run afoul of the Constitution, although people would argue about that. So there are people who are looking at this in ways that are reasonable. We'll see what, again, it's a huge lift in any direction, legislative or constitutional change.
I'm a big fan of term limits, always have been, not only for the president and the legislators, the Congress, but also for judges. It's one of the reasons we elect judges. We're one of six states that still elect judges in this country. And I always had to run every 6 years. And I think that holds you accountable to the public. The argument about having life terms for judges has always been so that they're free of the political process. If you were to ask the average citizen today, whether or not, even with the protections of tenure, life tenure, whether or not this court is free, the majority of the public, given all the polls yes. now, says they're at an all-time low. There's probably a third, 30% they're down to in terms of their approval rating.
Do they care?
I think to the fact that Coney Barrett is out there doing mm-hmm. what she's doing, yeah, I think they care. I think John Roberts cares. Do I think that some of the more extreme people on that court care? No, I don't. I don't think they care.
So one of the other interesting points of that interview with Norah O'Donnell is the question about whether this president, Donald Trump, can run again. And a pretty direct question, right? And as far as I'm concerned, pretty direct answer to the mm-hmm. Constitution, which Amy Coney Barrett acknowledged, but is there a fudge factor here? Is there something that we're missing?
Interestingly, on The View, they just asked Justice Sotomayor that same thing, and she said the Constitution speaks for itself.
Yes.
And
I think they all seem to be saying that.
Yeah. Right. But they want to make sure that if there's a potential case that's going to come before them, that they're not on record as having taken a position. And I don't want the court taking position. I don't want justices taking positions prior to a case coming before them. I think that's a slippery slope that's very dangerous for this country. They should at least have the appearance that they're impartial going into deciding a case. And so I think they're making the statement that the Constitution speaks for itself and we'll interpret the Constitution and you'll have our answer if and when the case comes to us.
Constitution is clear. Constitution, as an aside, is also clear about where tariffs come from. It's in Article 1. That's a legislative function. You got the Federal Circuit recently saying president can't be doing all this. That's headed to the Supreme Court. Fascinating to see what the Supreme Court will do in resolving that issue.
And again, layperson, as we go to break, when just like in Wisconsin where the legislature was and governor were handing things to the Supreme Court to sort out, seemed like a lot of that's happening with the U.S. Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's a good development. We have a Congress, we have a president, and a court. Mm-hmm. Let's all sort of figure that out.
That's sort of what Coney Barrett, Justice Barrett, said in response to Norah O'Donnell asking her about the Dobbs decision, the overturning Roe versus Wade. And she said, this is not a job for the courts. This is a job for the people to decide and for the legislators. They've got a job to do, and that's to represent the people. And these are issues that belong back in the hands of the people in the states. Well, she neglects to tell you one thing, and that is Roe v. Wade also stood for the proposition that women have a privacy right under and protected under the Constitution. This Dobbs decision says they don't. And that's what's opened the floodgates for at least 14 states banning abortion.
Mary Kudemensch, Jim Santel, we'll wrap it up with our contributors after this on Point Taken on 620 WTMJ. All right, typically we do closing arguments, but I didn't give my heads up. So let's just do some final thoughts. Retired Milwaukee County Judge Mary Kudemensch.
You know, some of your listeners were saying, you know, what can we do? We feel so powerless. Don't let, you know, many politicians want you to feel powerless. That's when we lose our democracy. I'm doing a book on my mother right now called My Mother's Voice. One of the things my mom did her entire life, and I've saved her binder, is she wrote politicians. She wrote letters to the editor.
I remember you telling me about this.
It's
very cool.
Unbelievable how she expressed herself, you know, as a woman born in the 1920s and how she felt she was engaging with her politicians. And when I go back and read those now, I think they're just as relevant today on some of the issues that we're facing as a country. So don't give up your right to vote. Don't let anybody take it away from you. And don't give up your right to assemble on issues you feel compelled to bring to the politician's attention. And don't give up your right to write letters to the editor, to write your congressman. They work for us. Be polite, be reasonable, but let them know you are a constituent, that you vote, and these issues matter to you. So don't feel powerless. In a democracy, that's the worst thing that can happen. We have to exercise our constitutional right to be engaged by voting and by writing our politicians.
Well said. Jim Santel.
Affirming what Mary just said, it was a group last night, sat down, civics group, and they authored 50-some letters, handwritten letters, to judges, legislators, some members of the executive branch, both here in Wisconsin and in federal government. And again, the notion that a handwritten letter shows up in the mail of a congressman or even a judge who's not going to respond to you, can't, but still, that's compelling. You never know what kind of an impact you have. The second point is, following up on what we just said before, where is our legislature? It is Article 1 of the Constitution. And when you talk about these issues related to immigration, we almost have immigration legislation about a year or so ago. The environment, obviously, commerce, agriculture, all these kinds of things. That was the design of this government, of James Madison and George Mason. Our legislature is now deferring to a president who legislates by executive order, rightly or wrongly, regardless of how you think about it. That's not how it should be. And then by default, we've got a Supreme Court that when those branches do not agree or there's other issues out there of the sort that Mary just described, the Supreme Court is now taking on issues of privacy rights and, yes, indeed, environment and education and commerce and foreign affairs. That's not where it should be. It needs to be in the legislature. That was the design. So write the letter to your legislators telling them to reassume control.
I love the message. Love the reinforcement. Real quick before we go to the news, rockier road ahead or smooth sailing for the courts in the land?
I think it's a rocky road. I think 2026 is going to be put 2025 in its dust. Wow. I think we're going to be seeing some major, again, many of these cases coming back before the Supreme Court. We've got a new Supreme Court docket coming up, major issues in all kinds of areas, 32 cases already. And I think the emergency docket, if it continues, is going to animate the lives and livelihoods of people in America.
Buckle your seatbelts.
All right. Mary Kuhnmensch, Jim Santel, always appreciate you. You will be back, of course, as we sort of sort through the legalities of our country's problems right now. Lots more to get to, including conversation about MPS and education in the next hour. Stay tuned. News is next, 620 WTMJ.
Broadcasting live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's time for Point Taken. Here are your hosts, Steve Scafidi and Kristen Braun.
And as I said earlier at the beginning of the show, Kristen is off till next Tuesday. We will carry on without her at least my history tells me that I can do that. We'll see how it all works out. We have a great hour coming up, talking about education in a bunch of different ways. Joining us at the start here is Quinton Claibon, Institute for Reforming Governments. What was your title? Research?
Senior Research Director.
Oh, you slapped a senior on there.
Right?
Okay. Let's
Audio medium.
Let's be honest about the gray hair. I win that competition hands down. So I always am fascinated by the way you look at education. You're a prolific tweeter and poster about education. Let's sort of narrow focus on MPS. So what are some of the big concepts we want to flesh out in the next few minutes here?
Yeah, I think the biggest one is actually breaking news. I haven't seen any reporters get onto this, so you're first on the story. So Milwaukee Public Schools, as people know, for about a year now, has been considering which school buildings to close. There is tons of excess space because people are just having fewer children these days, sometimes in the case of MPS.
Just for the baseline numbers. They own a lot of buildings.
Let's put this. It's 154 buildings, yeah. But people can't really conceive of that. Let's put it this way. You could take the entirety of the Racine School District and put it into the Milwaukee School District, and you still wouldn't be full.
Right.
Same for Appleton. You could take Brookfield, or you could take Elmbrook and Waukesha counties or districts together and fit them in there. So there's tons and tons of space.
All right. So what's the breaking news part of this?
Yeah. So after a long period of time, they went from 26 buildings that they were considering down to 13, down to 10. They came up with a list of 5. So they're starting with 5. I think that was shocking to a lot of people. Maybe could have started with a little bit larger number. But these are the buildings for those interested. Hopkins, Lloyd, Clark, Seifert, or Heath, and maybe Douglas. So these are going to be considered. They're going to come to the community over the next 2 weeks. Happy to read some dates before I go. But this is a chance for the community to engage and decide if this is indeed the direction that the district wants to go.
One of the things that people always talk about is the cost of facilities, and probably even more specific is the upkeep and care. We're going to probably talk a little bit about the lead abatement that had to go on just to get kids back in schools. What kind of numbers are we talking about for facilities that in many cases aren't really being used? They're sort of still there. We have to make sure they're functioning. We have to make sure they're heated. What are we talking about here?
Yeah, exactly. This is from the consultant that is working with Milwaukee Public Schools. They said a small school, about 250 students, costs about $5,000 more per student than a large school like 350 to 450. So that adds up to, you know, a cool million over time on each school building that has to do with this. And you talked about money. Let's also not forget that, especially in some of these larger buildings where you have maybe unoccupied, unobserved hallways, that a lot of, you know, safety issues can also occur there. So this is a safety issue, it's an academics issue, and it's a money issue.
All right, so let's talk lead abatement. I know you didn't specifically look at that, but that problem has been around for a long time, and I've chastised everyone from MPS to legislative leaders to governors to anyone involved that this should have been fixed years ago, but it wasn't. So we're dealing with school children being impacted by lead. I feel confident about the leadership of the new superintendent, Brenda Casilius. It seems like she understands these concerns, whatever they are, about the school district, largest school district in the state, and seems to have figured something out early in her tenure. Are you feeling the same way?
Yeah, for those of you who are lightly employed, she will be speaking at Marquette University midday tomorrow, Wednesday. Okay. So feel free to ask her some questions there. But yes, I think the thing that's been most exciting, besides getting out in front of the lead issue and being honest about the financial issues that occurred over the last year, she's really gotten a focus on reading. People say, you know, all the other things that MPS focuses on, you need to focus on core academics. For about a year, the Milwaukee School Board was trying to convince the MPS staff, the teachers, and the union to make sure that we can get some really great reading retraining going on. This is something that's happening nationwide. It's why states like Mississippi, Massachusetts, and Florida are like rocketing up the rankings to the top three, and something that Wisconsin should do, basically reteach teachers how to get reading right. But the teachers didn't want to come in after school. They didn't want to come in during the summer, and so it just wasn't getting done. They even had a vote. They voted it down, trying to get some reading training for teachers. She came in. About a month later, all of a sudden, there are now 4 half days occurring this school year, meaning kids get to stay after school for tutoring for a half day, and all of these teachers are going to be finishing up this retraining. So basically, a long story short, that means by September 2026, we're going to start seeing scores going up in Milwaukee Public Schools.
We're going to take a break here. Quentin Claibon from the Institute for Reforming Government joining us in studio after the break. Lots to talk about the financial piece of all of this and more MPS-focused conversation on The Point Taken on 620 WTMJ. Continuing my conversation with Quentin Claibon, Institute for Reforming Government, IRG, Senior Research Director at IRG. A lot more from your research on MPS. Where should we be looking at? What should we, the public, the citizens of Milwaukee County, be looking at?
Yeah, so I mean, I always feel like radio is a public service, so I would like to give the dates out. So for anyone who wanted to participate, in the first segment, we talked about how 5, maybe 6 school, Milwaukee Public Schools buildings are under consideration for being closed, probably summer 2026, 27. So it starts next week. For those who want to go there, and in 2 weeks from now, it'll be September 22nd, 23rd. There'll be some virtual sessions, and then September 17th and 18th. So 17th, 18th, 22nd, 23rd, and 2 virtual sessions. Meet at the schools. You can go to MPS's website for more details.
So we all remember the dust up about finances in MPS, missing deadlines. Where are we at currently on all of that?
It's great to come in and have good news about the direction.
Okay.
Some reading improvements are happening. Some buildings are you know, savings is being considered. So very long story short, Milwaukee Public Schools went dark in the first half of the year. Probably not good. They ended up missing their kind of catch-up deadline, but they're on pace now. So essentially, they have a few they have basically a couple of last pieces of paperwork for their audit, which is missing, which led to some penalties from the state education department, the Department of Public Instruction. They're catching up on last year. And the good news is, rather than just kind of focusing all their attention on that, they've kept up to date with this year's finances. So they actually turned them in on time. So as far as we know, December 2025, all the finances will be in. That will help make sure that kids in Milwaukee Public Schools are getting the funding they need. But it also makes sure that districts statewide, which are really affected by MPS's finances, they're not going to be affected either. So it's good news.
In your professional opinion, as a senior research director, why was that allowed to happen? in the first place?
Apparently from I won't claim to have all of the emails, but the Institute for Reforming Government, IRG, feel free to go to our website or follow us online.
What's the website?
Reforminggovernment.org. Reforminggovernment.org.
Awesome.
So so we got some emails from the Department of Public Instruction. They actually were on top of Milwaukee Public Schools in the previous year before the scandal happened. January comes by, they're like, hey, where's that paperwork? We're gonna take funding from you if you don't get it in, and things followed through. The year that the scandal happened, no email. And then we found some emails that as the kind of drop dead deadline came up, all of a sudden there was some scrambling at Department of Public Instruction, realizing, oops, should have gotten this going earlier. And by then it was too late.
In your opinion, again, a professional opinion, what is the biggest challenge for MPS going forward? We talked about lead abatement. That seems to be in a resolve with finances. Obviously, facilities. What do you think is the sort of that big one out there that they have to fix?
It probably unites the conversation that we've been having: lack of trust from both the community, people who are not sending their children there, and from the parents in Milwaukee Public Schools. So, a reason that a lot of these reforms didn't happen: reading, buildings, all this stuff, finances. It's because any change can scare parents. Voters everywhere prefer the status quo to change, right? But change is happening to us. Milwaukee, unfortunately, Milwaukee County is losing people and especially losing children. So they kind of wanted to keep the status quo at their detriment. Luckily, if the community engages through, for example, the September meetings with buildings, hopefully all the changes that are coming up for MPS will not scare parents, but realize that they're actually headed in the right direction.
So this may seem counterintuitive, but somebody asked me this, so I'll ask you. With less and less kids, shouldn't it be easier to get these kids to focus on education? Nothing's easy, of course, in education, but does that make any sense at all?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's, again, a reason why a lot of these buildings need to combine. Imagine having to pay for two science labs, two teachers, all this stuff when there's a teacher shortage. Much easier to have, one classroom of 25 students rather than two classrooms of 12. And again, this is something that's not just going to affect Milwaukee Public Schools. There have been charter schools and private schools that closed this past summer. In Milwaukee and statewide. So this is something that's affecting the entire state, and hopefully if we can get in front of it, that means we will be able to refocus on education rather than just kind of fighting over money all the time.
Going back to the superintendent, Casilius, do you think she has demonstrated early in her tenure that she's all in for Milwaukee?
I all in for Milwaukee? I don't think there's any question of that. I think she has been honest about things like reading, about closing buildings, about the mistakes of past superintendents and boards that you wouldn't say if you didn't intend to be here long term. You would just smile and wave, right, and not really do anything. She's digging into the key issues early, and so I hope the community can gather around her. This is an opportunity for a fresh start, and kind of clear our mind from the past and focus on the future.
Because the texter asked, is she willing to take on a very powerful teachers union?
Gave two examples just on this call. First, on reading, convinced the teachers union. I would love for a journalist to find out what happened there, but convinced the teachers union to have some teachers do some extra training days, and then also made sure that teachers were in classrooms rather than kind of centralized at home office. So she seems to be making, agree or disagree, at least difficult decisions, and rather than defying the teachers union, working with them and convincing them to go in the right direction.
He is Quentin Claibon, Senior Research Director at IRG, Institute for Reforming Government. What's that website again if they want to follow your great work and your research?
Reforminggovernment.org.
Let's not make it 6 months next time, because you are probably more than most people in this community know a lot about this school district and what's going on. So thanks for all of that work.
School year's going. I'm happy to do it.
Yeah, welcome back, kids, faculty, administration, parents. Let's do it. We should celebrate Milwaukee. It still is. Last time I checked, the biggest city in the state.
Something to celebrate for sure.
Absolutely. Thanks as always. We'll take a quick break. We're going to have some fun in the last segment of this half hour of the second hour of Point Taken. Kristen is on vacation. If you're wondering where she is, she'll be back next Tuesday. I'm good, though. We'll make it fun and certainly going to talk some football because I love football. We'll do it after this on Point Taken.
The Bears still suck.
Oh, you wouldn't think I was going to let that go. I was watching all of that Monday Night Football game last night, and Bears looked so good, but as I said on Twitter or somewhere, classic Bears, defense, average, offense, crappy, and their field, as usual, worse than ever. So I thought, let's listen to someone who works in that market, one of our teammates, Sylvie down in Chicago at one of our affiliate stations, had some interesting comments after the game. We had to edit this, but here it is.
That game could not have started off any better. If you told me I'd be on the swing tonight, I never would have guessed. Even if it would have just been a normal loss, you can't be up 17-6 against a new quarterback in your building after he just threw a pick six and lose that f***ing game. I shouldn't be on this swing. You're going to call me a one-trick pony. You're going to say the bit is old. This isn't a bit. It's my swing of sadness. I'm f***ing sad. The Bears lost the opener again, and now Detroit's out for blood in week two. A lot of work this team needs to do. A lot of work. Accuracy. Processing. F***ing penalties. When you have more penalty yards than rushing yards, you're in trouble. It's all that pre-snap stuff that we told you about training camp. We're not panicking. But I'm f***ing pissed, and I'm f***ing sad. And they f***ing did it to us on a picture-perfect opening night.
That was a picture-perfect. Your field looked like crap as usual. I know it's the Park District, but this team has gotten away with this nonsense for so long. It's dangerous in some cases. And they were basically hammering their field before the game. I know they have concerts there. And whatever Soldier Field is, it's not one of the greatest stadiums in the NFL by any stretch, although they'd like to tell us that. And I like Chicago. I'm a big fan of the city. I worked there, lived around the city, worked in the city. Look, for some reason, they're like a sports hellhole now. They can't get anything right. Now, maybe this beautiful new stadium in Arlington Heights will be the answer. I don't know. It's got to be better than what this is. Well, you talk about a sad sack franchise, which should be the opposite since they've been around just as long as the Packers have. This is it's like a death sentence. You go there, quarterbacks are all fired up. They're, you know, high draft choices. This guy, Caleb Williams, heavily recruited. Everybody wanted him. And now he can't hit a pass over the middle to a wide-open receiver. I don't talk about sports, except on Sundays for Packers pregame. But this is nuts. This is nuts what's happening in Chicago. The Cubs, what are they doing? They can't win a series. They can't close it out. Now the Brewers are going to win the division again. How many years in a row is that? Chicago Bulls, they suck. Bucks won a championship most recently. I don't know what to tell the folks in Chicago, because I know a lot of folks in Chicago listen to this show, which is, by the way, a good lifestyle choice, because this is a great station to listen to. Even when you live in Chicago or in Illinois, I love that. So thank you for that. I just wanted to play what somebody from Chicago, fan, teammate, had to say about your team. It is not looking good. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a cry. That's a baby crying. Now, he's not. He says he's not panicked. Sylvie says he's not panicked. He's panicked. They're all panicked. Because when I saw that, what were we told before this season? Oh, Bears might surprise some people. All those sports guys, and you know I love sports guys because I work with them on Sundays, all tell me this is the year that Caleb Williams sorts it out. Yeah, no, that's not happening. Now, they have a tough game, a tough schedule coming up. I have no idea what they're going to do, but whether you get the early Bears or the late Bears, you can't shrug off the late part because you like the early part. This is a team in flux. This is a team that's going to be playing in a strong division. Packers looked fantastic on Sunday. We'll see what happens on Thursday against the Commanders. We saw them the Vikings. And it was that weird situation where I have to watch a game where I want both teams to lose. And as anybody who follows sports, that typically doesn't happen. You can have a tie on occasion. The NFL doesn't happen very often, maybe once a year. But that's what I was cheering for. But I got rewarded, because if I'm going to sit here on my pendulum of what I hate more, Bears or Vikings, it was Vikings for a little bit. Now it's back to the Bears, just because they're so snarky. And I actually hear those guys, because I don't hear Minnesota radio, because Paul Allen's a lunatic. He is a lunatic. Trust me on this one, the play-by-play guy and also a talker on KFAN up there in the Twin Cities. I have fans up there as well, because they can listen on the internet. You can tell him if you want to. I think he's a lunatic. Doesn't mean he's not good at some things. He's a lunatic. But for Bears fans, here's my advice. Just settle in. It's going to be a while. Now, Caleb Williams could end up being great. Could be an awesome quarterback. He is not even close to that right now. He makes dumb decisions. He's not a winner yet. Hell, Justin Fields may be better than him, because he looked pretty good in a loss. So there's potential. Settle down. You should be a fan of the Arlington Heights idea, because the farther you can get away from Chicago is probably a good decision for their sports teams. I would suggest they all do that. But just take a pill and stop saying you're going to win the division. You're not winning anything. Caleb Williams, who knows? All right, we got local news. We got the big guy today, John McCure. We've got a great guest coming up, Carlson Morgan, my friend, who's going to talk about more about education. A great new segment on the program. I love that. Let's play some of that up. I'll go to break with that. Yeah, absolutely. They do suck. Let it go. Let it go. Absolutely. All right, we got local news. Before we get to any of that, here is the latest from ABC News. Oh, I'm excited about this. We don't often have new segments, but we got a good one. Forward Thinking, my friend Carlson Morgan, representing City Forward Collective. It's a local nonprofit helping to have great schools, education for every Milwaukee family. We've known each other for a while now. We've talked away from the show, and we've done some other work on the station. First of all, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me in. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, and we sort of had an education hour with some information from my friends at IRG. So I always want to have our audience know who I'm talking to. So I know who you are, but talk about yourself and a little bit about City Forward Collective, because it's a great organization, doing some great things. But how did you get there?
Yeah, great question. So, I'm a kid from Milwaukee. I was born and raised in Sherman Park. Started in public school, ended in a private school, which is the story for so many families across the city. I left, went to college. For me, that was Harvard. Spent the first decade of my career.
Harvard, you say?
Harvard, I say. First decade of my career as a classroom teacher, and then a district administrator in New Orleans, which is a fascinating story that we can dig into more some other time. But about 8 years ago, came back home. I'm, amongst other things, a parent just like many of you. And I'm excited about the work that we're doing to ensure that every kid in Milwaukee and ultimately across the state has a high quality school.
So we'll get to City Forward Collective, their mission, but I have to think that being an educator sort of set the table for you, overused cliche, to sort of do what you do.
Absolutely. Look, I know how transformative the education that I got was for me. I got to Harvard. I know you're talking about Chicago a little bit before. I did go to University of Chicago too. Still a Packer fan.
There you go.
That educational journey that I was on has opened so many doors of opportunity. And I know there's so many more kids across the city and across the state who have every bit the same amount of potential that I do. And so absolutely, yes, that's what drives me in the work.
And that was one of the things that attracted me to have these conversations a couple times a month. I started working with you guys at City Forward Collective, and your mission is one I think we have to tell people about, especially as much as we talk about education, we talk about early in the hour. So talk about your organization, what you're trying to do here.
Yeah, so our work is quite simple, right? We know that families in our city are working hard, trying to do the best. They care about their kids, across the board. You can't find a family in the city that doesn't care about seeing the best for their kids. Our job is to come alongside, partner with our schools, partner for our parents to ensure that every kid in Milwaukee has access to a great education at a high-quality school. And we know we got a lot of work to do to get there, but we're committed to it.
We always talk about shortfalls. We just saw a banner headline we were looking at during the break there on $100 million deficit, facilities, core curriculum, teaching, what to teach, how to teach it, all the issues, and we're going to flesh some of that out in the second segment. But as you look at our state of schools and education, not just here but in Wisconsin, give me your assessment.
Yeah, we've got a moment of opportunity. Right? We have spent the last year talking a lot about education, and a lot of the things that you've raised, a lot of the challenges financially, academically, and otherwise. And I think that's important, right? We got to be clear-eyed about where we're at. We can't fix things until we first acknowledge the problems. But it also means we've got an incredible moment of opportunity, new leadership at Milwaukee Public Schools, significant new resources. I know, not as much as some people would hope, but, we're now two budget cycles into, six, seven, eight figure investments in K-12 education, in ways that are impacting all the kids in our city. So there's more work to be done, but there's definitely opportunity.
Why do you believe you and City Forward Collective can make a difference?
The answer isn't me by myself or even City Forward Collective as an organization by itself. The answer is all of us working together. That collective in our name really does mean something, right? We've all got to be invested in our kids. I don't think there's a more important challenge facing our community than ensuring that our young people have the education that they deserve to be able to find the career, operate our democracy, live the life that they choose.
One of the things I've noticed in our previous conversations is the positive forward thinking. That's one of the reasons we're calling this side forward. That's a character trait that I admire. I always tried to pride myself on looking forward. We can talk about the past. We learn from it. We sort of solve problems, and then we can hopefully do better next time. But when you talk about education, we have to look forward, because every day, I should say every year, we have new students who are entering the educational environment. We have to look up for them, have to give them that fresh start.
Look, this is my favorite time of year, you know, not because of the pumpkin spice lattes. Those are okay, too. But because, right, you know.
You don't know that I don't like those, do you?
Well, now I do. You know, but, it's over the last month, you know, just in the city of Milwaukee, about 110,000 kids put their backpacks on for the first time, met their new classmates, met their new teachers, right? Fresh beginnings and new opportunities abound. You know, I talked about new leadership at the district, but even across the board, right? Like, you know, I take my own kids to school most mornings, and I love the energy that they come to the car with every day when they're telling me about, you know, here's what we did today, and here's the first thing, you know, first new friend I made. You know, it's just a reminder that, you know, for all that's going on in the world, like, the kids are our future, really.
I love that message. He is Collison Morgan, City Forward Collective, local nonprofit working to enhance our educational system and ecosystem, probably a better way to put it. Lots more to come. We'll do it after this on Point Taken, 620 WTMJ. I love it. New segment that we're going to do every couple weeks here on Point Taken. Kristen, by the way, is off. She'll be back on Tuesday. Forward Thinking, Collison Morgan from City Forward Collective, local nonprofit working to drive transformation. I love that term, positive thinking in Milwaukee's educational ecosystem. We learned about you and the organization. So I have sort of laser focused on the idea of how we teach our kids. A lot of terms thrown out, core knowledge, core curriculum, not an easy word to say. Collison Morgan, what does that mean to you? And how do we like make that sort of, I think, an important focus of education in general?
It's absolutely the right place to start, right? You know, how we teach our kids. We've had a lot of conversations, for instance, about reading as a state. You know, there's been good work in Mississippi and Louisiana and other places, and it's now coming here to Wisconsin as well. A couple of years ago, the legislature passed a bill, Act 20. You hear the new superintendent at Milwaukee Public Schools talking about the work that they're doing at the district level. You hear this Milwaukee Reading Coalition and the broader efforts across the city to ensure that every kid is being taught, you know, what we used to call phonics, although it's more than just phonics, but ensuring every kid is learning the basics of how to read. You know, we talk about an education. Once you learn to read, then you can read to learn. But if you don't learn to read, so much of the rest of the knowledge of, you know, your time in school is inaccessible to you.
Somebody made this point to me, I think it was last week or a couple weeks ago on the text line. When you build a road, the road is only as good as its foundation. When you teach a kid, that's only as good as what you put in at the beginning of it, because they just layer all that stuff on top of everything else they've learned.
Absolutely. And the foundation for this road, right, is the ability to read, the ability to understand letters and sounds and make those things make sense and process that. You know, we know how to do this. It's, you know, there's lots in education that we're still trying to figure out. This is one thing that we actually know how to do, and where places have committed to this over time, we've seen real results. And, you know, we're a little bit behind the curve here in Wisconsin, here in Milwaukee, and getting this done. But I'm really excited to see our city come together in a way that maybe we haven't seen in 20 or 30 years around this is the issue we're going to tackle. We're going to make sure our kids know how to read.
One of the things that you and I were talking about during the break is connecting kids, parents, faculty, teachers, all of that. That connection is such a big part of this, because you got to have everybody engaged. If you ever have a solution, it's generally, in my opinion, as someone who's a former local leader, the best solution comes from all of that input coming together. And not that you're going to agree about everything, but you sort of find a way.
Absolutely, right? You know, and, you know, the thing I love about working in education, we all care about kids. Like, you know, we were just talking about reading. You're not going to find somebody out there that says, I don't want kids to read. I don't think they should know how to do that. Right? You know, what we're trying to figure out is how do we best get to the place that we all want to get to? Kids who are literate, kids who are prepared for a career, prepared to operate democracy, participate in our society, do all the things that we aspire for them to do. But we're all coming at this from a place of we believe in our young people and they deserve the best.
I forgot to at the beginning. Where can they find your organization?
Great question. Best place to find us is on the web. We're at www.cityforwardcollective.org.
Yeah, and I encourage all of you to check that out, because, as I said, Kyle's will be back every couple of weeks, and we're going to layer our knowledge and your work at City Forward Collective on sort of that foundational beginning as well. One big question that I get on the text line, I just saw a text pop up about it. The issue of kids not in school.
Mm-hmm.
That's that connection thing again. You got to get parents involved.
Absolutely,
in that.
Right? You know, I was sharing it before, right? I start my day every day by getting my kids to school, and right, you can't learn if you're not there. You know, it seems simple, it seems basic, but it's a challenge that we've faced, and it unfortunately has gotten a bit worse as we've come off post-pandemic and people have, you know, work has changed and life has changed. But I think, you know, making sure kids are in school every single day is absolutely foundational.
You mentioned the pandemic. You can't talk about education in the last 5-6 years without mentioning the pandemic. Your thoughts about how that was handled, and more importantly, how we've done and dealt with it since.
Look, I don't. There's only so much, you know, looking back that I think is worthwhile for us to do. What we know and what is clear, even just this morning, we saw some new results from the nation's report card, NAEP. Earlier this year, we saw the results for our younger students. Today's results are for our older students, our 8th and 12th graders. And across the board, it's clear that we have lost real ground. Kids, in some cases, are performing where they were a decade to a decade and a half ago. You know, we didn't get it right. And I think we got to acknowledge that. And then we got to figure out what are we going to do about it, right? We've got a generation of kids that are still working their way through the system, and we've got to repair some places that were missed and continue to educate every one of these kids to be prepared for their future.
And I
it's often a critical challenge.
Absolutely. And I also mentioned to my friends who do what I do for a living on the radio, you can complain about it all you want, but what we do for our kids going forward and forward thinking is the name of this segment, and Collison Morgan joining us, on the show, is so important. You can always fix things. But you got to identify the problem and then come up with some ideas to fix them.
And we got to be willing to put some of the politics and some of the ideologies and some of the battles of the past on the side. There's a time and a place for it. I get it. And I understand it. But, you know, let's start with our kids, right? If we can start with our kids and what they need, far more often than not, we're going to get to a better place and a place that we can move forward from together.
One of the reasons I wanted Collison Morgan on the program, because one, he's really smart and he knows education and he will find a way. And this is something we've all been talking about. But as I said on this show, we're going to not dwell on the negative. We're going to look at the positive. And thanks for being here. We'll see you every 2 weeks.
I'm excited for it, Steve. Thank you for making the space for this important conversation.
And away from the show, we love to talk anyway. So it's sort of a fun way to just continue that conversation.
Absolutely.
Collison Morgan, City Forward Collective. One more time on the website.
www.cityforwardcollective.org.
Yeah, local nonprofit advancing education in that educational ecosystem. I love this idea, and I look forward to future forward-thinking segments on this program. Have a great rest of your week.
Thanks, Steve.
We'll wrap it up on Point Taken minus Kristen Bry after this. Man, that show went fast, but boy, we were guest-heavy today. I loved it. Great guests. And from the big announcement from the county executive, David Crowley, and everybody loves Mary Coon mentioned Jim Santel, former retired Milwaukee County Judge Mary, and then, of course, Jim, who I worked closely with in 2012, former U.S. attorney. Quentin Claiborne on MPS and all the challenges. And then Collison Morgan, forward-thinking new segment on the program. We'll do it every couple of weeks from City Forward Collective. Absolutely outstanding, super smart guy. And I know some people say this isn't true, but I generally try to look at things in a positive way. And when I see and hear what City Forward Collective is working on to sort of improve that system of education, that environment, that ecosystem, I'm geeked about it because that's actually doing something instead of complaining, which is unfortunately what most of the people that do what I do for a living. So just that's a little editorial. Want to highlight a couple things. Now, I have another trip that we're working with Fox Road Travel, Rose Gray and me going to Cancun first week in February 2026. Now, it has not sold out yet. I know it's selling very well, and it'll probably sell out at least by the time we do the big show up in Oshkosh in a couple weeks. But I would suggest you get in because, one, it goes right from Milwaukee to Cancun, direct flight. We only have limited space left. It's a great price, and Secrets Divine is an absolutely spectacular resort, all-inclusive, the best of the best. Wine features are amazing, and I'm a wine drinker, and probably you are too if you're going to go on the trip. But don't wait. And this is sort of the breaking news part of this story. We're going to do an hour of show content down there. I don't know how we're going to do it yet, but we're going to haul some equipment down and do an hour of show content with the travelers, the listeners on the trip, and Rose Gray and yours truly. So you'll be part of a future segment or segments on the program. That's going to be one of the highlights of that, what they call and what we call the Winter Come Along with Steve's Committee 2026. Cancun, how do you find it? Well, you go to Fox Road Travel and Group Tours, and you can find it. Winter Come Along with yours truly. Or go to 866-GO-FOX-GO. The price is amazing. The resort is amazing. Amazing. You can look it up. Secrets Divine, Cancun. We're going to have a blast. Anyone who's been on a trip with me knows that's the expectation, and that's the delivery. And as Rose often says, I over-deliver. We have trivia contests. We have group chats. We have informal versions of Ask Steve Anything. We get together for our group dinners almost every night. Whether you, if you want to, you don't have to. You can do your own thing. Funny story, we're on a trip. I think it was Germany last year. Listener trip. A lot of great listeners went. And Kathy and I got to the restaurant early, and it was a river cruise, Avalon River Cruise, which is fantastic. And we were sitting by ourselves, and no one was sitting with us, which is weird because every other meal, this was toward the end, towards the end of the trip, we're like, where is everybody? Well, we find out later, no one ever sat with us. We had like a private dinner. Well, I talked to my friend Jose, who's on that trip and is going to be coming with us to Sicily next month and probably some other trips in the future. He goes, we thought you guys wanted some quiet time. We're like, no, we didn't want that. We have plenty of quiet time. We have a cabin. But it was sort of a funny way that we celebrated a quiet dinner, even when we didn't want one in Germany in that case. So find out, 866-GO-FOX-GO-A, winner, come along with yours truly, and Rose Gray. That's a trip on its own. Trust me, she's awesome. So that's coming up. Podcast. People ask me about my podcast all the time. We got some great guests coming up. Martin Moore is coming out on Scafidiology this week. Here's a great one coming up in a couple weeks. Eric Bilstead, my old teammate who he used to work with in the Scafidian Bilstead days many years ago, and Anna Roberts, two news guys who are really good at their job. They're going to join me on the podcast and a whole lot more. I've got a great guest I'm interviewing today for an October podcast. And of course, you need to listen, Kristen and Steve. Kristen's on vacation till Tuesday, but I'm coming back rip roaring tomorrow on a great show. So thanks for listening as always.